2002 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents session number 256, Seerstones, Scrying, and Translating Holy Writ. Can a government espionage program help us understand Joseph Smith's translation methods? A paper presented by Paul H. Smith with a response by Dan Vogel.
Welcome, everybody, to one of the afternoon sessions at the Sunstone Symposium. I forgot to grab my book and note the number. 256. We're excited to be here. I volunteered to chair this session. I've had a long-term interest in parapsychology. I gave a paper a couple years ago at Sunstone on the subject, and Paul contacted me shortly after. He wasn't able to attend, and he and I have been sort of some email friends since then, so I was very pleased to be able to introduce him today and introduce his topic, as well as our respondent, Dan Vogel. Paul Smith has a BA from Brigham Young University in Middle East Affairs, as well as art and English. He has a master's degree from the Defense Intelligence College, and he's currently enrolled in a PhD program, I think, at the University of Texas, is that right, in Austin? As you can tell from the abstract, Paul served for quite a few years in the government with a remote viewing program at Fort Meade, Maryland. And he continued on and has had quite a bit of experience past that. And through those experiences, Paul became quite interested in starting his own instructional program into remote viewing. My understanding is that he has the thought that all of us have these capabilities, and so he's helping people who are interested in trying to unlock the abilities to do remote viewing. So he's the president of Remote Viewing Instructional Services, and he recently just chaired a conference that was, we were commiserating with each other about all the details and all the fun things that could happen when you put on conferences. But it was a very successful event as far as attendance goes, and nonprofits are nonprofits, right? For the rest of it, but Paul's a very interesting person. And we always welcome him to Sunstone. He seems to manage to come out here every few years, and we're always glad when he can. Dan Vogel, I didn't quite get any biographical information from you, so I know a little bit about Dan through his own books, and if you'd been here a minute ago, I would have hit you up for some more information, so I'll let you fill in any details. But Dan is well known to many of us as just a longtime author and student, especially of early Mormonism and Joseph Smith. I know he's edited a book from Signature Books called The Word of God, which is a collection of essays about scripture and interpretation. He's the author of a very important series of books that I know many of you probably have, and it's the Early Mormon Documents series through Signature Books. He's what he's doing basically is providing the copies of the original works that are so interpreted by everybody. This way you can go and see them themselves, and it really helps us kind of get an understanding that all history is to some degree interpretation, and people choose to ignore or not ignore or to nuance and not nuance certain documents in different ways, and it's a wonderful service that he's doing with that. I know another title is he's a co-editor with Brent Metcalf of a brand new book from Signature Books on the it's a essays on the Book of Mormon called The American Apocrypha. I know it's Religious Seekers, and what's the rest of that title? And The Advent of Mormonism is another book that he's wrote, and he also wrote another one on Indian origins and the origins of the Book of Mormon. Indian something. I know all these books because I sell them when I used to work at Benchmark Books, and but Dan's an energetic researcher, and he's also a critic of parapsychology, as I found out 2 years ago in the session that I gave. And so it'll be an interesting dynamic. I think we'll have a fun discussion today. So let's turn the time over to Paul. Kind of the standard 30 to 35 minutes. Dan, maybe 10, 15 minutes, and hopefully some nice interchange between us all. Thank you.
I have to apologize. Just as I was getting on the plane, I also came down with a cold, and I'm self-medicated up to the gills, and it's clouded both my mind and my throat. So hopefully you'll understand what I have to say, and I'll understand what I have to say. You see the title of my talk here is about essentially Joseph Smith's means and methods of translating the Book of Mormon. Now, I don't want to get hugely mired in all the historical debate about that, because there's been a lot that's been said and a lot been discovered, but there remains a lot that's probably not going to ever be understood fully just because of the incompleteness of the record. But nonetheless, I'm going to touch on some of it to provide a context for what I want to say further. By various accounts, it seems that Joseph Smith translated the first 116 pages using what we've come to describe as the Urim and Thummim. That at first was not the term used. They referred to it as the Nephite interpreters. Now, when those 116 pages went missing, somewhat in punishment, the interpreters were removed from Joseph Smith's custody, and the evidence is pretty slim that he ever got them back. It seems most likely that he translated the balance of what we know as the Book of Mormon using what we've also come to call as a seer stone. And in fact, his close associates all seem to agree pretty much on the method that was used. Here are some quotes from them. And when you boil it all down, it seems that the method involved putting the stone in the crown of a hat and then Joseph placing his face in the hat so as to exclude the light, the ambient light there. And then from that point on, he dictated sentences in English. Okay. The use of the seer stone is kind of downplayed a bit, I think, but if you read the accounts, it seems to have played a very important role. Now, the interesting thing about this, during doing this talk, I don't even have my paper up here, the interesting thing about this is that it closely resembles a practice known as scrying, which has been around for a long time. And of course, people thinking of a prophet with his face stuck in a hat, translating a document they can't even see, that seems really bizarre to a lot of folks, and it disturbs a number of people. I think that part of that is just because of our cultural background now. Back then, it probably didn't seem quite so weird, and many things we do today would seem very weird to them back then. At any rate, scrying is related to an old English word, descry, which means basically to catch sight of something that is obscure, to discover or detect something that might be at first hidden. And it's been around for a long time, but let me read briefly from a description of someone who's written recently on the topic of scrying. He talks about how his grandfather did this. He said, "The method of my grandfather was quite simple. He constructed a small box out of wood about the size of a square shoebox and lined the inside with black velvet. Within it, he kept his crystal ball. When he wished to gaze into the crystal, he would completely cover the box and his head and shoulders with a large piece of black velvet as he sat on a chair before the table peering through the darkness of the crystal." Now, there's obviously some similarities here between this, putting your black velvet over your head, and Joseph Smith sticking his face in the hat. The writer goes on to note that his mother, who is the daughter of this grandfather, found this practice very odd because, she said, it would have been impossible to see the crystal itself, never mind what was inside the crystal. So she and the rest of the family always wondered what he was staring at. I think that question has arisen with Joseph Smith as well. Our normal stereotypical notion of a scryer is like the old gypsy with the crystal ball foretelling somebody's future. That is, we talk about fortune telling, we talk about crystal balls. That's really a form of scrying. But lots of things are used, not just crystal balls and not just gypsies. Here's just a quick list of sorts of things that might be used in scrying. And the how much illumination is present also is important, although that changes individually according to the taste of the scryer, whether it's dark or light. Oh, okay, sorry. Booster chair. You got a high chair? Okay, is that better? Okay. Well, we could get comfortable, lay down. That's still on the ceiling. More or less compromised. Okay. Different scryers like it dark or like it dim. Others like it brightly lit. It all depends on their particular taste and their particular approach. Now, scrying is, for a long time, been associated with become this folk magic. It's been practiced for centuries. And oftentimes the instrument, the crystal ball or the mirror or whatever, is deemed to possess some sort of magical properties that allow this process to happen. And because of that, because of this supernatural association, Joseph Smith's use of a seer stone in what closely resembles the scrying process has led to two main objections against his claim of having translated Holy Scripture. Now, I'm going to briefly mention the first one, that is that this is generally from a religious believer perspective, they object that it's, you know, it is magical, and it, you know, since it's not of God, it must be of the devil, and you know, they use scriptural references to say that, you know, this kind of thing is not approved of by God, and therefore Joseph Smith could not possibly have been a prophet because he's using a practice that is condemned in the scriptures and by God. Well, that argument in and of itself is a fairly weak one because we see instances in the Old Testament, particularly, of, you see, people using divining techniques and what we would call scrying techniques and those kinds of things, and were indeed condemned by God or by a prophet or whatever. But we also see prophets and priests using similar divination techniques or you know, scrying techniques here. Urim and Thummim is a prime example. And those are approved by God. Particularly, instance, David uses the ephod to determine where the enemy has gone that he's trying to attack and what's going to happen there. And what seems very clearly to be a divination process. And a few passages before, Saul goes to consult with the witch of Endor and conjure up Samuel, and that, of course, is you know, reprehensible. So we see that whether or not a practice of this nature is evil or good in a religious sense has very much to do with whether it's one that God approves of or not, or whether it's a person that God approves of. So that in and of itself is no conclusive argument against whether Joseph Smith was a prophet or not. Okay. The other argument, which I think is more relevant generally, and has been employed both by people with religious background and those who are not particularly interested in religious objections to this, is that scrying and that sort of behavior is just remnants of an old superstitious age and no longer of any relevance. And it doesn't work, and it's just smoke and mirrors, so to speak. Okay, and so they find fault with Joseph Smith because the process that he used couldn't possibly be of any relevance, and what he produced then must be suspect by it. Okay. Now, I'm hoping to show that this objection itself is relatively bankrupt and that it actually doesn't work. But to do that first, I want to go and describe the translation process a little bit more thoroughly. Not on it. Okay, how did Joseph Smith do the translation? Whether he was using the Nephite interpreters or the stone in the hat method, Joseph would look through or into the chosen instrument and dictate English sentences for a scribe to write down. According to Emma Smith, when her husband would resume work after an interruption, he would pick up the translation where he had left off without review or rehearsal of previous passages. Reportedly, Joseph couldn't carry on the translation if things in his personal life were not in order. David Whitner noted an occasion when the prophet was angry with his wife about something she'd done, and after trying and failing to translate, he had to make amends, after which the process continued as before. He went along with this process day after day, apparently translating, producing English sentences far better than the English that anybody believed he could produce. And whatever mechanism through which he produced this seemed to allow linguistic usage and idioms of the period in which he lived to creep in. There are those who think they have detected in the Book of Mormon lines from Shakespeare, linguistic oddities of the King James Bible, or phraseology peculiar to early 19th century American English. According to witnesses of the translation process, it was seemingly unnecessary for Joseph to refer to the plates themselves while he was translating. They didn't have to be there, or if they were there, they didn't have to be visible. Frequently, they're wrapped in a cloth that would have not allowed him to see the characters on the plates. And yet, he continued to translate. Obviously, with his face in the hat, he's not going to be able to see the plates anyway. And so he doesn't seem to need the original manuscript, actually, to do this translation. However, there's some interesting things. He would spell an unfamiliar name, according to Emma, as it was encountered in the text, and would correct her spelling if she wrote it down wrong, even though he couldn't see what it was she had written. even though he continued to translate documents after he gave both Urim and Thummim and Seer Stone up, he found at some point he no longer needed them. In other words, he was able to translate. He needed instruments at first, but then at a certain point, I guess he decided he didn't need them. He no longer employed them, and then can still continue to translate. Stephen Ricks makes this observation. He says, "Why should Joseph use any kind of means whatsoever, be it the Nephite interpreters or a seer stone or anything else? Orson Pratt, for instance, asked the question reported that the prophet told him that the Lord had given him the Urim and Thummim when he was inexperienced in the spirit of inspiration. But now Joseph had advanced so far that he understood the operation of the Spirit and did not need the assistance of that instrument. In fact, after he had completed the translation of the Book of Mormon, he gave the seer stone to Oliver, saying, I have no longer any use of these, of this. Yet he continued to translate even after that event. So, the question arises here, was this translation literal or was it conceptual? In other words, there are those who want to think that that Joseph Smith was given the words that he was supposed to write down in the Book of Mormon, word by word, sentence by sentence, and it came out exactly the way God wanted to be expressed. But there are some reasons to believe that. Royal Skousen has written a paper suggesting that, which has got some interesting points, but I think is a little inconclusive still. The other alternative is that it was a conceptual translation. That is, Joseph was given the concepts into his mind, and then he had to search around for the right English words to express those. There is some reason to believe this, how Oliver Cowdery is told to translate in the Doctrine and Covenants and seems to support a conceptual sort of a translation. And generally, the wording many times, particularly the anachronisms that seem to pop up in the book, such as these alleged phrases from Shakespeare in the King James Bible, seems to me can best be explained if you assume that Joseph is giving a conceptual notion and then just picking up a useful idiom and plugging it in there to save him trying to figure out what words to use. B.H. Roberts has really come down very hard on the side of the conceptual notion, conceptual approach. And on the other side there is evidence from David Whitmer, Martin Harris, and Joseph Knight, who talk in general terms about Joseph saw in the interpreters or in the seer stone English sentences, and then the characters, and then an English sentence would pop up, and then that was what would be written down. Roberts doesn't think this works, and he cites a number of pretty good reasons why he doesn't think that would happen. And he thinks that Knight and Whitmer and Harris just were misremembering what was said. Well, that could be. You'd expect their account of the outward process, where they're watching Joseph with his face in the hat or whatever, you'd expect them to remember that very well. But if they had just been told or whatever about how it actually happened subjectively with Joseph Smith, you wouldn't necessarily expect them to remember that as well. So maybe they got it garbled up. And there are discrepancies between their accounts to some degree. But it may be that they do remember. Maybe Joseph Smith did tell them how he did it, and it did involve, he did tell them he saw these images in the stones. Of course, Whitmer's version is that the sentence in Reformed Egyptian appeared on something like parchment, with the English translation appearing beneath. And if that's indeed what happened, then Robert suggests that interpretation, after being wrought out in the prophet's mind, was reflected into the Urim and Thummim and held visible there until written. In other words, it wasn't really in the Urim and Thummim, it was in the prophet's mind, and he was projecting that notion. Okay. Now, let's talk about scrying a little bit more. What are we supposed to be done? Okay. Then I'll try to be uncomfortable and get it all done. Okay. Most of the history is practiced. Scryers have presumed that the instruments they employed, whatever that might be, crystal ball or seer stone or whatever, had some kind of magical virtue in it, that the implement was really important and necessary. Okay, they thought they saw in them visions of distant vistas or events that allowed them to presage, give predictions and stuff, or give counsel to those who sought their advice. And there may be scryers today that even believe that still, that their instrument has some magic in it. But more recent developments suggest a different interpretation about this, that there is no actual virtue in the instrument itself. There's no magical powers, no supernatural reception by the stone or the mirror or whatever. Instead, the idea is that the instrument is really only a means of leading the scryer's own conscious awareness into an hallucinatory experience in which what seems to appear before the eyes is actually being processed within the visual centers of the brain. One of an online friend of mine who practices scrying sent me this email. He says, "The mirror's job is to fool the optical mechanism into not being able to judge depth or focus on a surface. In doing so, the occipital portion of your brain, where images are interpreted, is stimulated with a point of focus. This then allows the mind to open to another energetic stimulation. Works great, best with about 7 to 12 lumens of light behind the scrying mirror. I have used a sheet of polished onyx and my television screen as an instrument for scrying." Okay. Whether or not his theory as far as the brain, you know, region involved is true, I mean, it makes sense, but doesn't necessarily mean it's true. That's hard to verify. Still gives you the idea of a kind of modern interpretation of what's happening. Okay. No matter how convincing it appears, there's no image present in the instrument, but only in the perceptual channels of the scryer's own mind. And someone who is looking at it at that point, you know, a disinterested observer might be observing the same instrument, not see anything. Even the scryer might see something. Okay. There's an interesting parapsychology experiment called Gonsfeld, the Gonsfeld technique, which uses half ping pong balls over your eyes and white noise in your ears in a very homogeneous sensory environment, which kind of mimics this sort of environment. And they've had some interesting results from that. Interesting, if controversial to some degree. Okay. Now, but there may be another purpose for this, the instrument, besides being utilitarian and focusing attention and being able to kind of limit your sensory experience so that it allows this other signal, if you will, to come in. This is an analogy that occurred to me way long ago, about 20 years ago, and I discovered other people thought of it as well, so I can't take absolute credit for it. But this is the idea of Dumbo's feather. Anybody ever seen Dumbo? The movie. Remember what happens? You've got Dumbo, he's got these huge ears and he's an outcast, and one day his mouse buddy discovers he can fly. And because he gets drunk, it's all complicated. But anyway, but in order for him to fly, the mouse gives him this magic feather that he holds in his trunk. And as long as he's holding a magic feather, he can fly. Well, one day he's diving down from the big top and sailing along, and the feather pops out and he's in danger of crashing. And the mouse tells him, "Look, it was a trick. It was all a trick. You don't need the feather. You can fly without the feather." And from then on, Dumbo, of course, was the star of the show. Okay. So it may be that this applies, in a sense, to scrying as well. It would seem then that there would come a point in a talented scryer's career where Dumbo's feather, the scrying instrument, is no longer needed. The scryer learns how enlightenment flows directly into his mind, learns that the stone or crystal or smoke mirror is superfluous, has always, in a way, been superfluous. The training wheels are put aside, and a mature seer moves on. Perhaps it was something along these lines that Joseph Smith meant when he told Orson Pratt he at first needed seer stone and Urim and Thummim because he lacked experience in the spirit of inspiration. Maybe when he no longer needed such implements to receive revelation, he gave up his own version of Dumbo's feather. It may, though, in fact, be possible to bypass this notion of Dumbo's feather altogether. And so at this point, I want to digress and talk about the government espionage program that I mentioned in the title. Many of you already have figured out I'm talking about remote viewing here, okay? For those of you who are a little new to the concept, I'm going to explain a little bit. I talked more at length in an earlier Sunstone presentation, and that's posted on my website, so I'll tell you how to view that if you're interested in the future, okay? The program that I'm talking about began in 1972 when the Central Intelligence Agency, concerned about extensive parapsychology research going on behind the Iron Curtain, contracted with the Radio Physics Lab at Stanford Research Institute in California to find out if indeed there was a threat from what the Soviets were calling psychotronic applications. And after about 23 years, well, I guess that's getting ahead of the story, the outcome of the CIA-sponsored part of the research was a discipline that became known as remote viewing. It's essentially, I describe usually, as a form of controlled clairvoyance. It's reproducible under experimental protocols in a laboratory setting under certain conditions. And using these remote viewing techniques, a human can receive mental impressions about a target that is blocked from otherwise normal perception because of distance, intervening obstacles, or time. Very roughly said, it's, I guess, a way of being psychic, although that has a lot of connotations that we don't like. The two main researchers, Dr. Harold Puthoff and Mr. Russell Targ, along with their staff and sources and research consultants and stuff, produced results sufficiently credible to justify remote viewing's use as an operational intelligence tool. Let me give you a quick example of what this means. A remote viewer might be asked to describe the interior of a secret laboratory in a foreign country to find out whether it is being used for biological warfare or not. And so let's say the analyst that wants to know about this may know that there are three different signatures of what could be going on. It could be biological warfare, it could be nuclear weapons research, or it could be they're building the next generation main battle tank. The remote viewer goes in, describes these huge beakers of viscous green liquid that seems intended to harm people by touching them or having them breathe it. Then the, well, it's not biological, I guess. Anyway, so the analyst then can conclude that, well, this is a chemical warfare facility, and they can discount the main battle tank and the nuclear weapons facility, okay? So that's a way we might do it. Now, one of the requirements is that the viewer can't know what the target is. They have to be blind to the target, and there's some practical reasons for that. If they have an inkling of what it is up front, then everything they know about that target is going to be right there, and it's going to contaminate the data they get. So they have to be absolutely blind to the target when they set out on doing one of these projects. Okay. Many sorts of targets were successfully addressed by government remote viewers, including research and development facilities, nuclear, biological, and even chemical warfare test events, Middle East hostage situations, foreign government meetings, weapons deployments, narcotic shipments, North Korean tunnel complexes, POW sites, and so on. I will soon talk about another sort of mission that is directly relevant to my talk here. I know you're all wondering when I'm going to get around to that. Besides thousands of fundamental research experiments, by the time the project was closed in June 1995, somewhere in the neighborhood of 400 operational intelligence collection projects were performed, involving thousands of individual collection missions that we call remote viewing sessions, in support of agencies ranging from the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the National Security Agency, the Secret Service, all four military services, the Coast Guard, Customs, Drug Enforcement Agency, Defense Intelligence Agency, Central Intelligence Agency, the whole who's who list of the U.S. intelligence community. Now, get away from all of that bookkeeping kind of stuff. Talk about remote viewing itself. There's some interesting things to note about it. Remote viewers cannot read words when they're remote viewing. That has, we think, something to do with the fact that our remote viewing seems to be localized in the right brain hemisphere, and it's the left brain hemisphere that has all the language, well, most of the language. Particularly reading skills and stuff like that is central there. And so you get the signal in, and the hemisphere that detects it is not able to translate it very effectively. Okay. So what that means is that remote viewing input is often in the form of concepts or impressions for which the viewer must find the appropriate words to express. So that should strike you as being somewhat familiar. On a limited basis, viewers can approximate names or words as phonetic equivalents. In one remote viewing session, for example, a viewer was able to tease out the sounds Tulu. The target was the Tulum archaeological site in Mexico. In another instance, the phonetic response was Bunker. The target was the Bunker Hill Memorial. Now, these are obviously not world-shattering kind of things, but it gives you the idea of what the capability may be. Within the constraints of the right hemisphere functionality, viewers can sometimes even get a few letters based probably on shape recognition. In its purest form, remote viewing is an attempt to school one's perception so as to discriminate between a real if very subtle perceptual stream and the mental noise that is always within our minds. And when I say mental noise, it's a product of two different things. One is our mind's mission to interpret the sensory perceptions we have. And so it's always assigning meanings to things that come in. And so when you get to the kind of the borderline area of perception, which this is, oftentimes it can be wrong. And it will tell you you know, well, this is obviously a bridge when it might actually be the Eiffel Tower or something like that. That's a one form of mental noise, these analytic conclusion jumping kind of things that go on. Another source of mental noise is called personal inclemency, and these are issues that must be acknowledged or resolved lest they interfere with the process. So, for example, you have a deadline that's pressing. The IRS just told you they're going to audit you. You've got some kind of personal problem. Or you're sick, or you're having a fight with your wife, something like that. Those things can actually get in the way of successful remote viewing. Okay. Now, despite the fact that no instrument is required in remote viewing, are we running very low on time? Okay, 7 more minutes, and then I'm done for. Okay. I still think that both remote viewing and scrying are related. Okay. In fact, those of us involved in these fields think that all of this stuff that we do out there, from dowsing to divining to shamanism to all of this stuff, there's an underlying engine that makes it work. And then all these other things are just kind of cultural overlays, different ways people decide that it has to be in order for this stuff to work. They make these metaphysical assumptions about it, and then these overlaid beliefs serve in their own way as Dumbo's magic feather for those people involved. But in fact, you don't need all that stuff, that there's got to be a core experience that you can get to that you allow to do this without all the external trappings. Okay? There's one instance, I'm going to skip over that in the interest of time, that shows the relationship between remote viewing and scrying. So this is how I think the two are related. Scrying is remote viewing using an instrument to aid the visual experience. Since scrying is primarily considered a visual process, and remote viewing gets data from all the senses, it seems that scrying must be a subset of remote viewing. Remote viewing, of course, is just a convenient label for this poorly understood faculty. Giving it a name comforts us with the illusion that we understand it just a little. Okay. There's some differences between the two. I'm not going to get into those. There are times when remote viewers can get words. Well, one example is a guy named Pat Price, very early in the remote viewing program, who, when working a target against a highly classified NSA facility in West Virginia, was able to actually get real code words from that project. Now, he wasn't totally successful. He gave a bunch of personal names that turned out not to have ever been there. But the code words he got to be correct. He had this very colorful term. He said he mushed his head into the filing cabinets somehow or other and extracted meaningful terms. Okay. And in fact, the interesting thing was the result of that was a 5-year-long counterintelligence investigation by the FBI to figure out just exactly how he did get those names. How did you really get that information? You know. So anyway, that was one instance where words actually were retrieved. And then 14 years later, there was another operation which now becomes relevant. This was kind of an operational experiment. They wanted to see if the remote viewers could actually determine the content of a document that they did not have access to, that was locked in a safe on the fifth floor of the fifth floor of the Defense Intelligence Analysis Center. And I realize I'm way behind on my slide. I guess you'll forgive me on that. There were two tasks they needed to. First of all, they didn't know what building they were being asked to target. They didn't know that they were supposed to go for a second task to describe the paper, the document. They had to find both those things out. They weren't told that. Okay, and so the document itself had to do with nuclear proliferations, arms control, weapons of mass destruction. And the viewers then proceeded and did their stuff. Let's see. This is from one viewer. This is his description after the fact. It's a large, flat-sided building with a predominance of structures that were square, rectangular, and brownish green in appearance. The structure was perceived as a government building with established visitor control points. Viewer 003 stated, "The setting reminds one of the DIAC, the Defense Intelligence Analysis Center," which was indeed where the document was. That's all I could find. The viewer went on to say that the cover of the target document had a red background, odd-shaped yellow and black lettering and border. Listing of numbers in rows with codes reminiscent of a series of BE numbers. BE is bombing encyclopedia. That's the document they use to designate all the targets, strategic weapons targets that they're going to use. Okay, so the viewer identified BE numbers in this thing. The subject matter of the document dealt alternatingly with arms control, technical aspects of weaponry, engineering constraints, design capabilities, and strategic considerations. And there's much more stuff, but I think in the interest of time, we have to skip. The second viewer, the target site, this is number 11, the target site described the target site as being located on the upper level, second or third floor, of an office area characterized by the presence of cubicles, desks, work areas, in a building like Building 213 or the DIAC. So he also had kind of an impression that it resembled the DIAC. Cover of the document was reddish-brown with black border. The document dealt with symbols associated with mathematical concepts and formulas, along with listings related to strategic arms and targets. I'm going to just have to summarize these other two. The next one described the building in more general terms. It said it had to do with biological. The document had to do with biological warfare and high-altitude burst of a weapon involving biological warfare. And the last one, again, described the document quite I'll read this part. Viewer 79 described the target site as a dark, glassy, curvy, modern-appearing structure located in a setting of low rolling hills amid interspersed fences and parking areas. Described the reception area, which was accurate. And then described the document as being an area dealing mostly with scientific research, which was true. She noted that the classification was secret, no foreign code word, which was also probably true. So anyway, I don't have direct confirmatory data. This is still embargoed by the CIA. In fact, I'm probably not supposed to be talking about this, but I can't see how I can hurt anything. This was in the final report. It stated that all four viewers appeared to quickly and readily access the DIAC as the target site where the document was stored. And a later report noted that in Project N1, which is this one, the content of the document was readily and substantially identified. Okay. This is obviously interesting. It seems evident from this particular episode that the viewers were able to at least gist the content of a document, which, at least conceptually describe what was in it. Okay. Even though they couldn't read it, they could get some elements of it. And their performance wasn't perfect, you know. You get things wrong no matter how good you are as a remote viewer, and I'm not going to go into why that is. Wrap up with race. Okay. I guess I'll see where I can cut through. Okay, this raises an interesting challenge to critics of Joseph Smith. Even in this limited way, normal garden variety humans can succeed in deciphering documents to which they have no physical access, it seems perfectly reasonable to think Joseph Smith could have deciphered in much greater detail the Book of Mormon, Book of Abraham, etc., if aided by the power of God in the process. And then I go on to discover, is this really translation? And I conclude it is. If anyone wants to know why I'm going to check conclusion, I'll tell you. But since I'm ending with grace, I'll skip to the chase here. I must make one thing very clear. I'm not saying that Joseph Smith was I'm not saying he was a proto-remote viewer and just accidentally stumbled on the process. That doesn't undermine his truth conclusions anyway, or his truth claims anyway, because it would still not account for the plates, nor the accounts of the plates that said they were coming forth wouldn't be accidental. Additionally, his detail and presumed accuracy was far better than any attributable to even the best remote viewer today. He was far better than anybody. If this is indeed what happened, he's far better than any remote viewers that I know of. It had to have come from some additional power, it seems to me. I'm not saying that Joseph Smith was merely a remote viewer, but I do feel comfortable saying that both of them come from somewhat the same underlying place, and which I suggested in my earlier paper. I'm also not trying to prove Joseph Smith's claims, though I do believe them myself. I think the fact that a remote viewer is able to, at least to a limited extent, translate a document shows it doesn't prove that Joseph Smith himself actually did that, because I don't think that proof's available anyway. But I think it does show that one argument against him doesn't go through, and that it's not possible to have used a seer stone to translate a document to which he did not have access most of the time. So my concluding statement is the nature of Joseph Smith's means and methods of translating alleged ancient documents are insufficient grounds to reject his claims. Thank you.
All right. Forgive me for
for just jumping in here, but I have a lot to cover in a short amount of time. There are two components to Paul's paper: the assumption that remote viewing is real, and that what Joseph Smith did with his seer stone is somehow related to remote viewing. I will examine the last proposition first. Was Joseph Smith a remote viewer or anything like it? I find Paul's comparison, remote. Sorry, I couldn't read this out. Paul asserts that remote viewers can translate into a limited degree, but fails to give any evidence of translating, although they saw, supposedly saw words. I have yet to find another scryer from Joseph Smith's time translating an unknown language. This was apparently Smith's innovation. I fail to see the similarity between translating and seeing things at a distance. Martin Harris, Dave Whitmer, and others report that Smith said he saw the translation in the stone and that he merely read it to his scribes. Paul, too, quickly brushes this evidence aside as a product of faulty memory and other Mormon scholars. Whether the translation was Smith's or God's, Paul agrees that it was reflected in the stone and then read, which makes his argument against Whitmer and Harris kind of unnecessary. Conformity among the various accounts is best explained as originating from Smith rather than Whitmer, which in a paper he applies that the other witnesses got their information from Whitmer. Joseph Knight's description predates Whitmer's and Harris's, as does also Eber D. Howe's 1834 report that, according to various verbal accounts, which were given out by the Smith family, through the stone, Smith could then discover a single word at a time, which he repeated aloud to his scribe, who committed it to paper. Then another word would immediately appear. The claim that Smith could correct the spelling of his scribes cannot be used to support Smith's ability as a seer. This claim is not borne out in the original documents, where some names went uncorrected, and Smith came back and systematically changed one name at least five times. It is not uncommon for true believers to spin their accounts, like I'm speaking of Whitmer and others, in ways that enhance the miraculous nature of the event. Nevertheless, I find Paul's use of the claim rather incongruous, since the story supported the witness's claim that the translation was mechanical, rather while Paul believes it was conceptual. In other words, Paul's assertion is that Smith translated conceptually, while at the same time remote viewing the scribe's exact spelling of words. I also wonder why Paul makes an analogy between, well, this is in his paper that he didn't have time to read, but he refers to a thing called the Chinese room and computer translating programs, where no one using the program has any knowledge of the language but can translate the language to a limited degree, both of which are closer to mechanical translation than to Robert's conceptual translation model. The working it out in your mind in DNC 9 has been widely misinterpreted among Mormon writers, beginning with B.H. Roberts, who used it to explain the Book of Mormon's anachronistic use of the Bible. Rather than accept the anachronisms as evidence against the Book of Mormon's ancient origins, Roberts invented the conceptual translation hypothesis to explain the evidence away. This is known as an ad hoc hypothesis, which is designed solely to deflect evidence against a central hypothesis. More on this later. Contrary to the assumption of many apologists, DNC 9 is not a description of how Smith's stone worked. Rather, it is a description of how Cowdery could translate with his divining rod, which dipped to answer in the affirmative and remained motionless for the negative. That is, if Cowdery's rod is anything like any of his other contemporaries. Needless to say, Cowdery did not find this method of translation workable, and therefore failed to translate anything. Prior to translating the Book of Mormon, Joseph Smith was involved in an activity that is perhaps better suited to Paul's uses. From about 1822 to 1826, Smith was employed as a treasure seer, claiming to see treasures buried beneath the earth's surface, sometimes at great distances. However, several problems arise from such a comparison. First, Smith never found anything, at least not the treasures for which he was sometimes hired to search, which does not speak well for his ability as a remote viewer. Second, Smith's use of the stone not only grew out of the magic work. Supported it in inextricable ways. In other words, if one believes Smith was a type of remote viewer, one must also accept the magic world view. Smith not only saw treasures in his stone, but also guardian spirits, bleeding ghosts who had been murdered on the spot to protect the treasure. He also saw enchanted treasures move through the earth to different locations, a concept that shows up twice in the Book of Mormon. Smith's magic worldview also carries over into his translation of the Book of Mormon. Unlike remote viewers, Smith could not translate without his stone. Martin Harris once switched Smith's stone for one he had found on the, or a similar one he had found on the banks of the Susquehanna River. He became convinced of Smith's claims when Smith was unable to translate with the replacement stone. If remote viewing is an innately human activity, as advocates claim, Smith should have translated regardless of which stone he used, so long as he believed it was the correct one. So, in Smith's case, one is under the necessity of believing that some stones possess magical properties. Briefly, my interpretation of this event is that Smith detected the switch and played along with Harris's expectations. The conundrum for those who believe Smith literally translated the Book of Mormon from anciently engraved plates is the fact that Smith used the same stone and the same method to translate the Book of Mormon. The implications are obvious. If Smith actually translated and received revelations with his stone, as Mormon apologists maintain, did he also locate real buried treasure by the same means? If so, why were none uncovered? Did they really slip through the earth as claimed? Invoking Occam's razor, it is easier to believe that Smith was engaged in fraudulent activity than to believe in magic and the suspension of the laws of nature. Now to the second part of my paper. Has remote viewing been scientifically established? Here I'm not an expert and I'm really not sure what you have to do to become one, but the vast majority of the scientific community regard remote viewing as utter nonsense. While this in itself does not disprove remote viewing, it does place such claims in perspective. What we are talking about is a fringe group who are trying to gain the respect of the scientific community. At present, despite such efforts, parapsychology is not a science. Parapsychology is to science what astrology is to astronomy. Most parapsychologists know their endeavors are pre-scientific, and some have even complained that parapsychological data are volatile and messy. Government research on remote viewing, much like its research on UFOs, was a product of the Cold War. The Soviets were doing it, so we had to do it just in case there was something to it. Because the CIA and U.S. Army once studied remote viewing does not necessarily mean that there is something to it. We all know the government doesn't waste our taxpayers' money on frivolous and useless research, right? At the same time, the government was also sponsoring UFO research. Some Mormons speculated that UFOs were the lost tribes returning to the earth in preparation for the second coming, a belief that they felt was supported by Joseph Smith's purported statements about the lost tribes being taken to another planet. I would point out that the government would have probably liked its enemies to believe it had remote viewing capabilities. And when the Cold War ended, it gave up its study of remote viewing. CIA spokesman Mark Mansfield said that the Stargate program was found to be, quote-unquote, unpromising. There is not time to review all the studies of remote viewing individually. The two major studies were done at Stanford Research Institute, or SRI, from 1973 to 1989, and Science Applications International Corporation, or SAIC, from 1992 to 1994. Instead, I will briefly discuss some of the errors and difficulties encountered in such endeavors. The government hired two researchers to review these two studies, Dr. Jessica Utz, a statistics professor at the University of California, Davis, and Dr. Ray Hyman, a psychologist at the University of Oregon and a skeptic. While Utz accepted the test results and emphasized the high scores as evidence for psi, or, you know, parapsychology. Hyman, more familiar with the mechanics and possible pitfalls of scientific experimentation, found a host of fallacies and flaws. To be scientific, these tests should be conducted double-blind, meaning both the psychic and judge are blind as to the true targets. However, investigators found that this was not always the case, and that in many instances, scientific protocol was compromised. Those unfamiliar with remote viewing might expect that the remote viewer just simply draws an exact representation of the target and gives an accurate description, and that this is easily matched against a list of targets. This is rarely the case. Most transcripts and drawings are vague and imprecise. This is an example I took off of Paul's website. I'm sure he would want one that was more exact, but I took one that was... one that's more representative of your average attempt. And can anybody tell me what this is? Good guess. Any other guesses? Yeah, there you go. And it says, I should read to you, man-made, feels natural, man-made. Okay. Would you be surprised that it's a building that is actually a there you go. It's that, the Colosseum. Okay. So I think you're getting the picture of what we're dealing with. Most remote viewing transcripts contain a mix of true and false data also when they write notes on the side. Some could be true and some could be false. In his presentation to the evaluation panel, Ed May, the chief investigator as well as the sole judge in SAIC experiments, estimated that 20% of the information supplied by the remote viewer is accurate. They call this false information noise, like Paul has, interference of the from the subconscious or wherever. This is nothing more than an ad hoc hypothesis. The history of science is replete with examples of this fallacy. If one is willing to endlessly form ad hoc hypotheses to dismiss negative evidence, the scientific process is disrupted and nothing can be disproved. The tendency to emphasize the similarities and ignore dissimilarities is another fallacy of retrospective falsification, as well as the fallacy of selective validation. This is similar to remembering dreams that come true and forgetting the multitude that do not. Confirming and disconfirming evidence hold equal weight when assessing scientific data. Frequently, the viewer himself does not know the meaning of the impressions or has an altogether incorrect interpretation of them, or what they would call analytic overlay. All this all depends on whether the judge thinks there is a match. A major flaw in the SAIC experiments was that only one judge was used for all used, and there was some coaching and leakage. Moreover, the judge was not blind as to who the viewer was, which helped in deciphering the transcripts. The vagueness of the transcriptions allow for a great deal of latitude in interpretation. This is far from being objective. Indeed, this is subjective validation, a procedure well known to psychologists and extremely problematic and unreliable. In their 1991 book, The Psychology of the Psychics, David Marks and Richard Kamen described in detail how subjective validation operates in many remote viewing experiments. As a control, judges were sometimes given the wrong targets or decoy targets. Nevertheless, the frequency of hits was the same, including some really uncanny coincidences. One major weakness in remote viewing studies is that they rely solely on statistical evidence, which is worked over and massaged for favorable results. This procedure is called meta-analysis, which is nothing more than rearranging the evidence according to one's own preconceptions. This is what psychologist Daryl Bim and psychoanalyst Charles Honerton did in their 1994 with the Gansfeld data to arrive at a hit rate of 35% over an expected 25% chance rate. However, when reviewed by other researchers, they came up with where they included all of the data, it was no better than chance. In the N1 test alluded to by Paul, one would need the raw data rather than the summary report from which Paul quotes to properly assess the results. At times, one cannot even distinguish between the viewer's statements and that of the reporters. Paul cannot even verify the accuracy of the report, which makes it an extremely weak example for remote viewing. Even if one had access to the raw data, one would be unable to determine if there had been lapses in protocol. That's why the presence of a trained skeptic is essential. I note that the experiment lasted for more than a month and wonder if there was not any interaction between the parties to create apparent unity, although I quickly add that the unity is more apparent than real. One viewer said that the building was flat-sided, building, square, rectangular, while another said it was glassy, curvy, and a third said it was large, walled-in building. The final report, representing another level of unification, said that all four viewers appeared to quickly and readily assess the DIAC as a target site. Yet there is no positive identification, although all the viewers knew that what the DIAC building looked like. The first said that it was only reminded them of the DIAC building, which might imply that it wasn't the DIAC building. And the second said that the building was like building 213 or the DIAC building. The remaining two viewers had differing descriptions and did not name the building at all. Here we see selective validation at work. In closing, science is a community effort. One laboratory or research group does not make science. Science data are validated through replication. Generally, what has happened with replication is that the more tightly controlled the experiment, the less likely remote viewing effect is seen. The looser the controls, the more effect is seen. So I would close this by just saying that to follow David Hume's dictum, a wise man proportions his belief to the evidence. So far, the evidence for parapsychology generally and remote viewings specifically is extremely weak and therefore provides no support for Joe Smith's claims. Thank you.
We have approximately 5 minutes. Paul, did you want to take like one or two at the beginning, or would you rather hear from everybody? Please come up and speak in the mic if you will, or unless it's really short. Okay. The question, Paul, if the plates were never used, why did Joseph have them, or were they given to him?
Yeah, that question that question's been brought up. Frankly, I don't have a conclusive answer to that. I mean, if you go with the theory that the scrying instrument is Dumble's magic feather, it could have played a role in that. It could have been essential just as basic evidence for the 3 and the 11 witnesses as well. So, you know, I don't know. You remember when he translated the Old Testament, New Testament, he didn't have the original text there. So, yeah, I don't know. I can't give you an answer that's going to satisfy you, but there's a lot of speculation you can come up with.
What the really found about this is that the Mondragon, for example, is that there's a possibility, but it didn't make anything of it. There's still certain surfaces that might have been nobody else to see them. There's a consistent narrative. And they've got on the part being trying to read.
Okay, so you're suggesting maybe actually found something, actually found some plates, but he couldn't decipher them,
yeah.
And so they kind of made up the content. Yeah, right, yeah. In other words, well, I mean, that's kind of the premise that I'm proposing here. But I just actually have thought of a question and answered your question there. It just dawned on me, and it actually has to do with remote viewing. In remote viewing, in order to address the target, first of all, you don't want to let the viewer know up front what the target is. You don't want to give them any information. So we generally use a random number that's been keyed to what the mission is. And the viewer is supposed to somehow, telepathic or whatever, pick up on the intent of the tasker. So we just give them 8675309, you know, maybe, and that's describe the Eiffel Tower. But we don't tell them to describe the Eiffel Tower part. They just take the number and then go through the process and hopefully describe the Eiffel Tower, okay? Now, wait a second. Now, it may be that those plates, I mean, there's lots of things you can use to serve as a, quote, coordinate here. It may be that the plates serve that function, to serve as the targeting mechanism to get him onto whatever it is he's supposed to describe. That's, again, just another speculation, but it just occurred to me, so I don't know. Gosh, I can't remember what he said. Oh, yeah, no, I, you know. And not really,
you weren't really asking this question much as you were just throwing out a possible hypothesis.
Yeah.
Here, we have about time for one more, so let's let this gentleman take it. I'll talk to you afterwards.
Say again? A website? Yeah, well, go ahead and ask. Somebody else ask a question while we're
anyone else have a question? We'll follow up with them. They do.
Okay, the comment is, why not just make this an automatic writing or a channeling a little bit more rather than to add this element of scrying? What advantages do you see, I guess, to calling it?
Well, again, I mean, that's the point. Maybe it's all the same thing. They're just different ways of approaching it. You've got different assumptions about, you know, metaphysical assumptions about how it works. And so some people would use channeling, but it still gets to the same underlying mechanism. Somebody else might use scryer, gets to the same underlying mechanism. Joseph happened to be into scrying, and so it worked for him. You know, just a possible explanation.
Just on that question, I'll pitch an old issue of Dialogue. Scott Dunn wrote a piece. It's in Dialogue, Volume 10, I think, number 6. Is it a response to it, or is it the actual? Oh, his essay's in there. Oh, great. That's very good. There's good information. We're out of time, but well, let's just thank both our speaker and our respondent and continue the discussion on our own here. Thanks.